This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, Judge Brett Kavanaugh wrote, "I know my tone was sharp and I said a few things I should not have said." Note that he regretted the words, not the anger. His display of outrage, of anguish, weren't for show. No, they were the whole ball game. Until this process ends, and as I write this, I don't know yet how, Kavanaugh hasn't yet won the post he seeks of Supreme Judicial Umpire. He's just a player, and the courtside contingent is mad.
What left-wing groups and their Democratic allies have done to Judge Kavanaugh isn't nothing short of monstrous.
A successful confirmation for Judge Kavanaugh this weekend would be the kicker to a nearly month-long revolt against the consequences for hurting women that the Me Too movement strives to apply. When we spoke with Slate staff writer Lily Loughborough last November, she explained several of the logical fallacies used by the culture to excuse or ignore bad behavior. We called on her again to identify the new fallacies she's seen lately. Like the anti-bandwagon fallacy.
The anti-bandwagon fallacy is something I kind of made up to explain a tendency that I've noticed where a news item's truth content actually diminishes for people as more accusations emerge. We saw, for instance, with Dr. Christine Blasey Ford.
I've never seen so many repressed memory cases in my life, especially against one guy.
Yeah.
So the question is, if there's something awry going on, was there hypnosis?
A conspiracy.
Yeah. When Moore emerged, a lot of people, I think, on the right interpreted that to be a bandwagon that invalidated the initial accusation. Something else that I heard recently is the Darvo effect or technique, which is a way that a lot of people who are accused respond.
DARVO stands for Deny, Attack, and Reverse Victim and Offender.
Donald Trump has really excelled at finding a way to turn every accusation against him into an occasion for his victimization and, by extension, the victimization of those who associate themselves with him. We certainly see Brett Kavanaugh doing something similar. We find male anger, I think, very disorienting because men are told to repress. And so when we see somebody in a very high-stakes situation emoting powerfully, that tends to us to scan as an index of authenticity.
In front of the nation, we saw his righteous indignation. He choked back his tears and aimed his fury not at Dr. Ford, but rather of this unfair confirmation process, which frankly is an embarrassment.
And I saw in the aftermath of the hearing a surprising number of pundits describing both his testimony and hers as equally credible, which I found astonishing. But once again, we tend to find anger, especially when it comes from a man, to be somehow corroborating. It's one of the things that we are taught.
Another thing that was on display this week is that men now must live in fear.
Right? I got boys and I got girls. It's scary. For all things. I mean, I wouldn't want
who are
my...
Who are you scared most for, your sons or your daughters?
I mean, right now, I'd say my sons.
Fear of injury to their reputation, essentially, regarded as equally weighty as women living in fear for their safety.
The most stunning revelation about the recent round of defenses of Brett Kavanaugh is that he should be confirmed even if the allegations against him are true. That is a blatant double standard that is being spoken aloud in ways that I did not expect.
It's almost a codification of boys will be boys.
it's popular right now to say, well, norms have changed, and back then people didn't know. They knew. It's not that any 17-year-old boy didn't understand that holding his hand over a screaming woman as she tried to escape was wrong. It's that he thought he could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
We all knew sexual harassment was wrong. We tolerated it anyway. That has been, I think, the line governing a lot of the Me Too movement and a lot of the response to it. What's truly surprising to me at this moment is that we are seeing a group that spent years laughing at the very idea of anything like, quote, rape culture, suddenly not just admitting that it exists, but arguing that it should. Male malfeasance is an unstoppable cocktail of culture and biology, and the subtext, stripped of all the pretense, is that the victims don't actually matter. Just by coincidence, as all of this was happening, I kept stumbling across news stories that almost laughably confirmed how overblown this panic about men suddenly being persecuted really is, because these are cases where men were found guilty in a court of law of sexual assault and received no jail time anyway, right? So in Anchorage, Justin Schneider was indicted by a grand jury last month on 4 felony charges, and he was accused of offering a woman a ride, strangling her until she was unconscious, and masturbating on her. But he got no jail time.
Schneider did not apologize for his actions, but thanked the judge for accepting the deal.
I'd just like to emphasize how grateful I am for this process. It has given me a year to really work on myself and become a better person and a better husband and a better father, and I'm very eager to continue that journey.
And the district attorney for the case, in fact, called him losing his job punishment enough. He called that a life sentence.
Wow.
Yeah.
You observed that a majority of the GOP has said that even if Kavanaugh is guilty of doing what he did, it isn't disqualifying. You think that shows real contempt for women's safety and that it gives the lie to the whole notion of courtliness and especially chivalry. What do you mean by that?
I mean that chivalry is a protection racket and always has been.
In other words, you give us your fealty, you allow us to limit your ambitions and control your speech and behavior, and you won't get hurt?
You won't get hurt, and maybe you'll be financially supported. But if you don't, you will be punished. That's the flip side of that, and I think that that has been exposed. You see what happens to people who step out of line. You see how Dr. Ford has been treated. You see how the other women who have spoken up are treated by the GOP, whether it's Dianne Feinstein, whether it's Senator Klobuchar, whether it's Cecilia Vega.
She's shocked that I picked her.
No.
She's like in a state of shock.
I'm not thinking, Mr.
That's
President.
Okay. I know you're not thinking. You never do.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
In a tweet this weekend, Mr. President,
we are in a moment where the status quo is trying its hardest to hypercorrect by saying out loud the things that it used to paper over with a socially acceptable veneer of chivalry. When you have a class of people who had things arranged such that in any situation that involves a man and a woman alone, the woman absorbs 100% of the risk to her physical safety and to her reputation, and he shoulders none, of course, they are going to be extremely upset. For men to have to shoulder any amount of risk under those circumstances becomes intolerable. Their distress is real. One of the things that really struck me during the hearing was how anger circulated in that room and how the one person not permitted to express any was Christine Blasey Ford. The theatrics that the GOP demonstrated in the second half of that hearing involved a lot of grabbing the anger ball, so to speak, and just out screaming.
You know what it reminded me of? In basketball, there's this thing that players do sometimes called flopping. They're touched by another player and then they fall hard on the floor, hoping that the umps call a foul.
And Boozer just throws Ori to the ground.
He didn't throw him. Robert Ori, every time he comes up to set a screen, if there's any contact, is going to fall to the ground.
All right, let's take a look.
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah. That is a strategic performance that cannot be honored. And I think that the Me Too movement has unleashed a lot of anger that has never been permitted to be expressed or felt.
Don't you wave your hand at me. I wave my hand at you.
When you grow up, I'll be good.
When I grow up, we grow up. How dare you talk to women that way? How dare you make that first?
You tell me when I'm talking to you, you're telling me that my assault doesn't matter. That what happened to me doesn't matter.
And I think that that is a pretty potent tool. And honestly, I think it's actually very healthy for people who have been repressing and bottling up their anger into a socially acceptable performance for as long as they have been feeling it, to be able to finally express it.
So are you talking about Democratic women or Lindsey Graham?
I'm talking about Democratic women. I think Lindsey Graham has been expressing just fine. I think he's okay. But when I see that a man is very angry, it's a very instinctive reaction. I'm a little bit afraid, and I think to myself, oh, well, he must be right in some way. I should retreat a little bit and give ground, that I find myself no longer being very impressed by. I think I'm not alone. The intimidating function that male anger used to serve, I think, is wearing thin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Lily Loughborough is a staff writer for Slate. Coming up, the bestseller, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, documents the demise of Native American civilization. A Native American writer takes issue with that.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This Monday, some parts of the country will celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, renamed from Columbus Day to honor the lives and history lost to centuries of colonization. What many of us know about the first people here amounts mostly to stories of loss, like the Trail of Tears and the massacre at Wounded Knee. David Troyer, an Ojibwe professor of literature at the University of Southern California, offers a re-examination of Indian life in his forthcoming book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. He begins his counter-narrative with the confusion that catalyzed the horror in Wounded Knee, South Dakota in 1890. Troyer says frontier soldiers spilled a flood of innocent blood because they were spooked by the ghost dance, a religion based on the vision of a Paiute spiritual leader named Vavoka.
It was a pretty vanilla vision. He basically said, we have to get along with white people. You have to work hard. You can't cheat or steal or drink. If we do all these things, well, then we will be reunited with our loved ones and our ancestors in the afterworld. It was almost Protestant in its insistence on a kind of work ethic. As it spread and grew and other tribes interpreted it differently, some people thought if they did the dances in the right way and wore the right shirts and did all the right things that they would be among the chosen and the saved and everyone else would be wiped away in a massive flood or some kind of catastrophe.
Meaning all the white people.
And all the native people who didn't do this stuff. So the ghost dance was a religion that was growing around the Pine Ridge Agency. And there was a troop buildup out of fear that this religion would lead once again to open armed conflict with the government. It was never going to go there. But the increased presence of troops put people on edge. Around the same time, Sitting Bull was murdered when they tried to apprehend him. That scared most of the native folk at Pine Ridge. And so everyone was kind of running for cover. A contingent of the reconstituted 7th Cavalry stopped Spotted Elk's band, Sioux, as well as some other allied bands, and surrounded them. The next day, they moved to disarm them. It's not really known what caused the shooting in the first place, but almost immediately, the government opened fire with Hotchkiss cannons on largely unarmed men, women, and children.
The descriptions of the massacre are horrifying. You quoted a reporter from the Deadwood, South Dakota Times, who wrote, "Why should we spare even a semblance of an Indian?" And then you have L. Frank Baum, author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, writing for the South Dakota Saturday Pioneer. He said, "Having wronged them for centuries, we had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up with one more wrong and wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth."
By virtue of being wronged, we're now a threat. Almost immediately after the massacre, it came to contain and symbolize all of the preceding 400 years of interactions between colonists and indigenous people in the New World. This was basically the end, and it stood in for everything that had come before.
Now, what most Americans know about the massacre, they learned from Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and the HBO film adaptation in 2007. Tell me about the importance of this book.
Oh, yeah. Dee Brown's 1970 classic, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, is the most widely read book about American Indian history ever. Published in 17 languages, never out of print. It sold over 4 million copies. I read that book when I was in college. I was thrilled to be introduced to a book about me. And in the very first pages of the book, he says something like, "This book is about the Indians' Plains Wars from 1850 to 1890. I start at the beginning of the wars and I end at the massacre at Wounded Knee, where the culture and civilization of the American Indian was finally destroyed." If you ever happen to travel through a modern Indian reservation and you notice the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, I hope by reading my book you will understand why. I can't tell you sort of how frustrating and how humiliating it was to be praised and held up on one hand and then silenced and done away with on the other.
One reason why you found Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee doubly dismaying, you put it, is because your reservation, the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, was a nowhere place where nothing happened and good ideas went to die.
It took a great amount of effort to try and see myself, the place I was from, and my people as more than simply a collection of eternal sufferers. You know, American Indians are once great peoples with a great future behind them. That's it. I was in search of a different story, not just different facts, not just a story of hope to stamp on the other side of the coin of despair. I thought that Dee Brown, despite his passion on the behalf of Native people, which I appreciate, missed the point. Wounded Knee was a low point. We had withstood constant assaults on our sovereignty, on our cultures, on our religion, on our families. So by 1890, we were very low, but we were not done. And since that point, we've been doing so many amazing things with such energy and intelligence to live fully realized and satisfying lives on our own terms. Toni Morrison once said that if there's a book you want to read and it doesn't exist, well, then you have to write it. And that's exactly what I've tried to do.
The occupation of Alcatraz, that was the year before Dee Brown's book came out. Describe what happened there.
Yeah, Alcatraz suddenly thrust Indians into the national spotlight. They declared it Indian land, and they camped out there, and they had a bunch of demands they hoped would be met, and they really weren't met.
"We wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with the Caucasian inhabitants of this land, and hereby offer the following treaty. We will purchase said Alcatraz Island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth, a precedent set by the white man's purchase of a similar island about 300 years ago."
I think it was kind of doomed from the start. There was a lot of chaos that occurred on Alcatraz, and that kind of tolerance for dissent, for drama, and even violence came along with subsequent activist movements in the 70s.
"Just as we got down there, the whole courtyard was covered with FBI agents with rifles. They all had rifles and shotguns, and they searched me."
I don't think it was meant to achieve a direct end, but to raise the consciousness of most Americans to not only our plight, but our continued existence, and also direct people's attention toward the responsibility of the government toward the first people of this country. And it did definitely do that.
In 72, you were a baby when a few hundred Indians led a caravan to Washington dubbed the Trail of Broken Treaties.
The caravan was the brainchild of both the American Indian movement and tribal leaders from places like Standing Rock. My own personal view is that the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which ensued, was in many ways skewed by the kind of unhealthy self-promotion of people like Russell Means, who was a Lakota activist, who was one of the founders of AIM, and who thought a great deal of himself.
Was it really an effort to get a meeting with President Nixon?
Yes. I mean, they'd hammered out sort of a bill of rights, if you will, that they were going to present to the government. They wanted the Bureau of Indian Affairs to be revamped from top to bottom because it had done a dismal job. It was paternalistic and it was short-sighted, and it lost billions of dollars of Native money that it was holding in trust that were the result of grazing and timber and mineral leases, among other things. The government still hadn't copped to the fact that it was ignoring its basic treaty obligations, and this takeover was supposed to draw attention to it. But then the people who were in the BIA trashed the place and did something like $6 million of damage to the building itself. And the whole occupation ended when these sort of dark agents of government, like Frank Carlucci,
one of Nixon's guys,
a bag man even then, agreed to pay them something like $66,000 to get them to leave, which they took. None of that $66,000, or at least not that I can tell, made its way into the rank and file and the very poor Indians who put themselves on the line to join that caravan.
And then there was another dramatic act of protest, and this time it was at the symbol of Indian suffering and injustice.
That's right. In 73, there was the takeover and the siege of Wounded Knee.
Well, I believe that the time has come that we have to commit violence in order to be heard. Now, I don't want to see anybody killed or anything, but the time's going to come when violence might have to be committed.
There'd been a number of very high-profile murders of Native people in the years leading up to 1973 in and around Pine Ridge and in other places in South Dakota, Custer, South Dakota, to speak of another symbolic place.
Mm-hmm.
And people were frustrated with tribal government, the federal government. They felt that there was no justice because these white guys who were murdering Indians were getting charged with things like second-degree manslaughter or misdemeanors at best. It was truly, truly awful.
And so for 71 days in 1973, Wounded Knee was under siege.
We have declared Wounded Knee an independent country. Any spy from the United States of America is found within our borders to be shot before a firing squad.
You say you had very complicated feelings about it.
I did. AIM activists showed up at Pine Ridge at the behest of a lot of community members to help them solve this rash of murders of Native people. The tribal government at Pine Ridge was very against this. Dick Wilson, the chairman of Pine Ridge, was interested mostly in staying in power, and he was working closely with the federal and state government to sort of bring in more and more law enforcement. So there's, this, again, another military buildup. Everything kind of boiled over, and AIM activists took over the Wounded Knee Trading Post and subsequently took over the entire village of Wounded Knee, at first holding village residents, some of whom were not Native, hostage. And then later the hostages said, we were free to go at any time. We just didn't want to go, because we figured if we did go, the government would kill all the Indians. So they were actually very sympathetic.
And Wilson was the head of the reservation?
He was the tribal chairman.
Sounds like you didn't have a huge amount of respect for him either.
No, he was a strong-arm guy. Tribal government was one of the few ways in those days an uneducated person could bilk the tribe and the government for a few years before they get voted out, but then they got a nest egg. It's totally cynical. Inside Wounded Knee, all sorts of dark and awful things were happening. Some law enforcement people were shot and some Native people were shot and killed. An African-American activist by the name of Ray Robinson showed up and disappeared within a week, and it later turned out that he was killed by an AIM security detail and buried someplace in the hills, and no one knows where. This was a kind of violence that dogged the American Indian movement for years to come, defined it in some ways. Also, on a local level, nothing really changed at Pine Ridge. There was still violence being done to Native people by white people, and they're getting away with it. There was still violence being done by Dick Wilson's government to other Native people, and no one was doing anything about it. And AIM didn't make it any better. But once again, what they did do was keep the issue of Native life and Native lives in the national consciousness.
Because that did have an impact.
It did.
There was some substantial legislation.
Yeah, there was amazing legislation finally passed in the 1970s that improved American Indian education. I remember going to school, this was in the 70s and 80s, but I did not have an American Indian teacher until graduate school. By the time my younger brother and sister, who are 8 years younger, went to school, they had Native teachers. They had teachers who were like them. And this meant a great deal to them.
And this was due to the Indian Education Act of 1972?
A lot to do with that. And in 1978, I believe, Carter signed into law the American Indian Religious Freedom Act.
Mm-hmm.
Until 1978, it was illegal for Native American people to practice their religion. We weren't being prosecuted by the government if we practiced our religions in the 1970s. But for Carter to finally grant Native American people religious freedom had an incredible effect. No longer, if you were a traditional Native person, were you suspect, were you dismissed out of hand or pushed to the side. So yes, a lot of good things happened in the 70s, and many of those good things happened because of bringing our case onto people's television sets.
We're speaking ahead of Indigenous Peoples Day, October 8th. The movement to change the name of the holiday really began in the early 90s.
Right. So 1992 was the 500th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in the New World. 1992 was also the cresting of the multicultural wave, especially in academia. People in African American studies, people, you know, Latino people, Asian American people were saying, no. In fact, the progress of human thinking and the evolution of human civilizations has never been simply the progress of white people. And people were not content to simply celebrate Columbus. People were much more interested in interrogating the legacy of colonialism, which was still being felt in populations around North America. And so not only Native Americans were protesting that very special Columbus Day, but Latinos were protesting and African Americans were protesting. And we all were finding common cause as we looked back at 500 years of colonialism and what it had done to us and how it had made the country. And so when the Spanish government decided in conjunction with the American government that they were going to send some replicas of the Nina, Pinto, and Santa Maria across the ocean, then around the United States, it's pretty tone deaf on the part of the Spanish government, if you don't mind me saying. Like, let's send these ships to the places where they introduced slavery to Native populations, mm-hmm. to modern populations descended from the slaves that were owned by Columbus and his brother, for instance. They were rebuffed. It just fizzled.
In the meantime, our government was planning a quincentenary jubilee to kick off 1992 with its own replicas of the three boats sailing under the Golden Gate Bridge, but corporate sponsors retreated, right? The jubilee never happened.
Exactly. Because American Indian activists and American Indian people just said, enough with this Columbus crap. We are not going to sit by and let you do this. And by 1992, we'd had generations of Native people completing high school and going to college and serving in the army and serving in World War I and World War II in Korea and Vietnam. By 1992, we'd had Native veterans coming back from the first Gulf War, for that matter. Enough with this.
So now the states of Alaska and Hawaii, Oregon, South Dakota, and Vermont don't recognize Columbus Day. There are cities, Austin, Texas, Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Seattle. They celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day.
It has a ways to go, but we've come a long ways.
So why don't we jump ahead to Standing Rock?
Okay.
You take issue with a popular narrative that was used by the former chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the author of a New York Times op-ed, who compared the treatment of Indian protesters and the Bundy brothers, the protesters who seized the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. He wrote, "On the same day that the armed Malheur militants were acquitted, I watched as riot police with military-grade weapons rounded up hundreds of peaceful water protectors in North Dakota protesting an oil pipeline. The juxtaposition of these two events, one system of justice for self-styled white cowboys and another for Indians, was stunning."
I don't buy it. There's a crucial difference that Chairman Archambault was missing here. The white supremacists, whatever you might call them, that at the Malheur Refuge, they were occupying federal land. The water protectors at Standing Rock were being arrested for trespassing on private land. The issue wasn't that white people were being treated differently than Indians, and I think to maintain that kind of us, them, Indian, white cowboys and Indians discourse is to miss the larger point that the federal government privileges private property above almost everything else. That's the problem.
But weren't the protesters at Standing Rock trying to protect what would ultimately be damage to their own land?
Well, of course. But the problem was that 90% of the pipeline was routed through private land. There were ways to reroute it away from you. You could meet with the pipeline and meet with the Army Corps of Engineers, as many tribes on the pipeline's route did. And subsequently, the pipeline was rerouted around those communities. But Standing Rock missed meeting after meeting, negotiation after negotiation, deadline after deadline, until the government finally, without their input, approved the pipeline under the lake and very close to Standing Rock.
What you're saying is that this us versus them mentality was a huge missed opportunity.
The original sin is that the government broke its treaty obligations and promises to the Standing Rock and other Lakota tribes, which resulted in opening up Lakota lands to private non-native ownership. That's what allowed the pipeline to go through, because our government will bend over backwards for private enterprise. To me, this is a story of local communities against capitalism, not cowboys versus Indians. Like, I'm sorry, but we already know that story. We already know what happens to Indians. We're sealing our own fate. Let's face it, you know, part of the problem at Standing Rock was that their government didn't show up for meetings. You know, I think it's really important that our activists put their bodies on the line, but I think it's also important that our elected tribal officials should put their bodies in chairs and show up for meetings. Don't get me wrong. Standing Rock was amazing and important and powerful. What was amazing about that protest was that they eschewed figureheads, and I would say chauvinist, sexist, violent leadership, like we saw in past iterations of Indian activism at Wounded Knee. We had a collection of the diaspora that was coming to the defense of Standing Rock. It was powerful and important, and the legacy of that protest will live on. Immediately after the protest was over at Standing Rock, the question of pipelines came up on my reservation. My reservation council had previously approved pipelines through the reservation. After Standing Rock, there is no way they could possibly hope to be reelected if they approved more pipeline leases. So it had immediate effects around the country. And this was the result of healthy, positive kind of activism, the likes of which we had not seen before.
So what is the narrative you want Native American, Native peoples to hold in their minds?
I want to once and for all destroy the sort of the narrative of Indians starting out in God's garden of the New World. Enter serpent in 1492, expelled from the garden to wander the earth in shame and poverty, right?
Mm-hmm. The Jews have that one already, so.
Right. We've heard that story too. You know, so often we think of Indian life as lives that are defined by having everything stolen from us. Indian lives are lives of loss. That's how our lives are most often understood. And I think a better narrative is to think of our lives as full of plenty. Plenty of injustice, but plenty of passion and ability to right those wrongs. Plenty of poverty, but also plenty of creativity and hustle in order to sort of overcome it. Plenty of crime, but also plenty of laws. Plenty of exclusions and traumas, but also a surplus of grit and ability and intelligence and creativity to overcome them and to do better. So in my mind, it's a story of surplus. That's the story I want to tell.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm really geeking out to be on the show.
David Troyer is an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. He's a professor of literature at the University of Southern California, a novelist, and author of the forthcoming book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Coming up, a game of Germans and Indians. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Indigenous Peoples Day on Monday will pay homage to all those whose ancestors and homelands were trampled with colonial disregard. The question of who should claim solidarity with this minority seems straightforward enough. But perhaps not, because Germany's racist far-right party, Alternative for Germany, claims kinship with the plight of Native Americans. German historian Frank Usbeck was dumbfounded when he first came across Indian imagery in an Alternative for Germany meme back in 2014.
I found it hilarious at first. It was in a tweet by one of the local branches of Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany. The tweet showed a photograph of Sitting Bull. It said, the Indians couldn't stop immigration and now they live on reservations. And that's what is going to happen to us here in Germany if we are not careful. Mm-hmm. And it's not even unique to Germany. In 2006, it was used in an election campaign in Switzerland. And ever since then, you find it in the argumentation and election campaigns of many European right-wing parties. Mm-hmm. Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Germany, Hungary. You find similar arguments in Great Britain and other countries as well.
It appears that these extreme parties are trying to appeal to Germany's profound fascination with the American frontier. And there's even a term for this phenomenon.
Indian enthusiasm, yes.
And you say that Indian enthusiasm and German nationalism actually share similar roots?
They go hand in hand. At around 1800, the Germanies were deeply affected by the Napoleonic Wars. All these German mini-states were either under military occupation or had been forced to become allies of Napoleon's. So nationalists tried to look for a unifying feature, something of a creation myth. The French have Joan of Arc, the British have King Arthur. So these early nationalists went all the way back to the Germanic tribes and their resistance against the encroaching Roman Empire. Interesting thing is that Tacitus, one of the very few sources, described these tribes as honest, loyal, heroic, fierce, and criticized his own society as decadent and over-civilized. If we go back to the late 18th and early 19th century, French philosophers Jean-Jacques Rousseau used very similar attributes, defining Native Americans as noble savages.
The Germans felt that their temperament was akin to that of the noble savage.
Exactly. Centered around notions of resistance, freedom, being attuned to nature. The forest was a sacred homeland, which throughout the 19th century became a root of blood and soil ideology.
And around the late 19th century, there was a writer who seemed to wrap this all up. And I'm guessing if you asked the average German on the street, why do Germans love American Indians? He or she would probably respond with the name of that writer.
That's right. So everything seems to lead to Karl May and mm-hmm. his famous couple of characters, the German immigrant and adventurer Old Shatterhand and his Apache friend Winnetou. The farthest west he actually got was Niagara Falls, way after he wrote his novels in the early 1890s.
He claims that he based Old Shatterhand on himself, so named because he could knock his foes out with one explosive punch.
Exactly.
Apache chief Winnetou seemed to be the really popular character among the German public, right?
Yes. He is an incredible Native American chief because he never hangs out with his own people. He's always out there by himself looking for white people he can help. And Karl May made him exotic enough to fit into the frame of the adventure. But as some scholars described it, he also seems to be a very good German. because he has character traits that the German bourgeoisie was supposed to strive towards, like honesty, bravery, industriousness.
These novels had a very long life. Was Hitler a fan?
Yes, it is said that late in the war, when there was hardly any paper left, Hitler allocated enough paper to distribute 100,000 Winnetou novels to the troops, because he said reading about Winnetou will help German officers deal with guerrilla warfare on the Eastern Front, that Winnetou was the ideal company commander.
But he wasn't white.
There were those people who said German children should only be confronted with Aryan heroes. However, Hitler was a fan. And also, pragmatists said it would cost too much effort to try to suppress German Indian enthusiasm. Why not harness it and profit from it? People like Erhard Wittek, a novelist who wrote under the pseudonym Fritz Steuben, said presenting Indian novels to German children teaches them about leadership and military training and racial ideology.
How does it teach about race ideology?
Erhard Wittek wrote about Tecumseh, and he likened Tecumseh not only to the famous Germanic leader Arminius, who defeated the Roman legions at the Battle of Teutoburg Forest in 9 AD. He also likened Tecumseh to Adolf Hitler, saying all three united people who were quarreling among themselves and make the people strong in the face of danger. He also said Tecumseh lost because the different Native American tribes that he united did not feel themselves as a race, as a people. So he could not form a nation. And that's what Hitler did when he united the quarreling German, and I'm doing air quotes here, tribes. But the other racial thing is that National Socialism defines itself as the most radical application of natural law. The leading Nazi newspaper, for instance, cited examples of infanticide and old people killing themselves among Inuit communities. The Nazis said this is natural because they are in this brutal struggle for survival and they cannot afford to drag along so-called useless eaters. The German euthanasia program used the same arguments later on in killing disabled people. People who use the meme on the internet have picked up how some Cherokees today try to expel descendants of Afro-American slaves absorbed into the tribe and given full citizenship after 1866. Right-wing extremists have argued in order to protect their cultural and racial integrity, it was necessary for them to expel the descendants of these Afro-American slaves. These right-wing extremists do not see the willingness of tribal people to adopt. And the Cherokee are an interesting example here because, as I learned, there are quite a few Cherokees with German family names.
Really?
And, yes.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You're welcome.
Frank Uzbek is a researcher at the Grassi Museum in Leipzig, Germany, and the author of Fellow Tribesmen, The Image of Native Americans, National Identity, and Nazi Ideology in Germany. After Germany's defeat in the Second World War, it was hacked into roughly two territories: the West, initially administered in patchwork by the Allies, and the East by the USSR. In the years to come, the German Democratic Republic, the new East German state, would struggle to shake off every trace of the Third Reich and capitalism, including the books of Karl May.
Those who are really officially in the Communist Party saw quite clearly what the identification between Hitler and the literature was: trash that should be discarded in favor of the new socialist personality. And they were forbidden to be published.
Evan Torner, a German studies professor at the University of Cincinnati, says that East German officials watched with horror as their decadent neighbors to the west churned out a blockbuster series of Karl May films, starting with The Treasure of Silver Lake in 1962.
This map shows the way to a treasure beyond price, and this man murdered to possess it. Now nothing could stop him leading his outlaw army to steal the treasure of Silver Lake.
A full-color, unironic Western. Why is that unusual? 1962, John Ford is still making films. But the apparatus to make the Western had kind of dried up by the end of the 50s.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S. And so then to make a sweeping panoramic Western about Winnetou and Old Shatterhand, right, going off and finding treasure, I mean, that seems really naive.
Tough and fearless, he braves the danger of the Utah Indians on the warpath.
But it absolutely captivated the children's audiences at the time, and it also showed off a production model that could work between multiple different European financiers. This became the basis for the famous Italo-Westerns by Sergio Leone.
You mean like A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
Absolutely.
Didn't the spaghetti Western inspire the U.S. to start making Westerns again?
Yeah, this is the European shot in the arm to the genre. Treasure of the Silver Lake is really the proof and concept that these could be cheesy or even experimental and really take historical license and still make a lot of money.
The East Germans produced their own feature-length Western.
There were 14 of them produced between 1966 and 1985. Native Americans as heroes fighting against the evil white capitalist cowboys who were coming to take their land. Those Indiana Filme, or Red Westerns, are produced every summer except for one during the length of the Vietnam War. The East German Westerns were a parallel commentary on American violence in the Third World. And I'd like to emphasize Gojko Mitic's role in popularizing it. He was a Yugoslavian stuntman. He had a ridiculously good-looking chest profile. I mean, he looked very good as a young man.
Dein Messer, das meinen Vater getötet hat, wird nicht in meinem Zelt Büffelende schneiden.
He played Tecumseh, he played a Seminole chief, he played an Apache. You know, he was their all-purpose Swiss Army knife Indian chief.
What was the overall message of these films?
These films tended to have the following arc. Show the tribe at relative peace, enjoying their lives. Then some evil white settlers would come and commit some egregious crime.
Sag mir's ganz.
Nein!
And then the Native Americans would have to decide, how are we going to resist this militarily superior power? And usually that meant killing the primary villain. And of course, it's always seen as a stopgap, but that the overarching arc of history is leveled against them, that they're going to lose eventually. The way that these films portrayed Native Americans were as proto-socialists, that if only they had known about Karl Marx, then they would have really been able to organize their labor into an effective resistance against capital.
One consequence of Indian enthusiasm was the formation of the Indian hobby movement. And you can still see Germans dressing up in traditional garb, dancing and singing at their own powwow. I mean, the descendants of European colonizers responsible for the genocide of the American Indian would not be cheered on for donning feathered headdresses and doing the dances of extinguished peoples. Germans have had their own experience with genocide. They don't make the connection?
There are a variety of ways you can read it. All this stuff is pretty offensive. That's just my preface. But when you were out in the wilderness, it was also a way of engaging in something that wasn't directly related to the state. You create your teepee, you whittle a flute, you put on makeup, you rediscover yourself, quote unquote, in the same way that people go to Burning Man now, which is, again, Burning Man is also in the heart of a major empire, namely the American Empire. The East German trick was that they were convinced that they were heroes liberating people around the world from the very beginning, Gojko Mitic saw the ridiculousness of the stuff he was doing. But he, on the one hand, said, well, we can connect this with real struggles of, you know, real Native Americans. We're thinking of course, Wounded Knee in the early 70s and other actual liberation struggles. He did comment on that when he actually got to start to write and co-direct, which was on the film Apaches and then its sequel, Olzana, 73 and 74. The Native Americans do not turn out so well there. They're in positions of violence and moral ambiguity that reflect what Gojko thought was the real state of the Native Americans in the U.S. And he kills Olzana, the Indian chief, and, you know, his own character, at the end of Olzana. And he stated quite openly that that is a representative of what's actually happening to the indigenous people, and that we should feel bad, meaning the East Germans, and that they aren't just these puppet Winnetou figures for us to endlessly play with.
Thank you, Evan.
No problem.
Evan Torner is a German studies professor at the University of Cincinnati. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi and Samantha Maldonado. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer, Josh Hahn, and Terrence Bernardo. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.